It's Monday, November 22, 2010. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Well, you noticed it and wondered if it could be possible. It was. Retailers started Christmas advertisements, merchandising, and displays back in October this year. This is an unprecedented beginning to the Christmas season that is pushing back not only far beyond Thanksgiving, but now even before Halloween. As a matter of fact, some retailing consultants are suggesting that one of the challenges that is going to come to American retailers is how to differentiate between Halloween and Christmas, or more likely, how to shift from Halloween into Christmas before indeed the trick-or-treaters are even back into their homes. Abercrombie & Fitch, a company that sells clothing to young adults and teenagers, began its Christmas promotions on October the 24th, even before Halloween, announcing on the tagline of its email, "We're feeling naughty and sneaking Christmas in early." Of course, Abercrombie & Fitch has felt naughty for some time, given their merchandising, which has been openly sexualized to American teenagers and young adults. Now, what we're witnessing here is something that might be called Christmas creep, creeping further and further back onto the calendar. Christians looking at this are often offended by pointing out that this is taking a commercial advantage of the Christmas season. But we should expect that this is what will happen. Christmas is now a major economic reality, with many retailers and businesses doing a major percentage of their annualized business over the several weeks of the Christmas season. For some businesses, it's even more acute. Christmas actually makes or breaks whether or not they will make money or lose money for the year. Profit margins and all the rest come down to the wire with every Christmas season. There is every reason to understand that in a fallen world, commercialization is one of the net effects. In a fallen world, people will take whatever they see as in their advantage in terms of pressing the business and the profit margin. The great tragedy here is not that there is a commercial co-opting of Christmas. The big problem is that it is so easy for Christians to get just as lost in all this confusion as everyone else. That's the greater tragedy. Who needs marriage? That's the cover story of this week's issue of Time magazine. You'll remember that just last week, the Pew Research Center released a report indicating that marriage is becoming more and more marginalized in American culture. The statistics are stark, and we'll be looking at them much more closely. But the raw data includes the fact that 39% of Americans told the Pew Research Center that marriage itself is becoming obsolete. Now, back in 1978, Time magazine asked the question, and only 28% of Americans said that. I say only because it's still shocking to me that as far back as 1978, some 28% of Americans would say that marriage is obsolete. There is something of a hesitation in looking at this data and assuming that it tells us everything we need to know about marriage. We know that isn't the case. But census data is also important, and that data tells us that a decreasing number and percentage of Americans, American adults that is, are married. That tells us far more about the marginalization of marriage. The Pew Research Center's report is going to receive a great deal of attention, but as we've often noted, the cover story in Time magazine on a weekly basis is prime media real estate. That tells us a great deal about the prominence that at least Time magazine accords to this new data and this big story. Do you need any reminder of the power of stories? Human beings are drawn to stories. We are narrative creatures. It appears that God made us that way. It's almost impossible for us to speak about anything important, including the basic fact of who we are and how we came to be, without recourse to a story. These powerful narratives take on an incredible energy in our lives. They also have a tenacity in culture. I say that because on Friday, the latest Harry Potter movie, the next to last of the Harry Potter movies we are told, was released to blockbuster success. No real surprise there. But it is interesting to note that those who were children and teenagers in the time the first book appeared are now young adults. The actors who played the parts in the original Harry Potter movie years ago are now themselves young adults. There was a lot of controversy about the Harry Potter books, and that's not my point today. My point is that when you look at this story, we are reminded that the stories and narratives of our childhood and youth do have an incredible power on us. Even when the story is badly told, or in this case, delayed in terms of the telling in the cinema, there still is an enormous attraction to it. The release of the movie came also with some analysis by reading experts that some of those children and young adults that got so hooked on reading Harry Potter actually never went on to read much else. That's a very sad observation. Last week saw a remarkable development in the publishing world, the release of Volume 1 of the autobiography of Samuel Langhorne Clemens. The title of the book is actually The Autobiography of Mark Twain, Volume 1, edited by Harriet Eleanor Smith, published by the University of California Press. Now, many people hearing that would wonder, how in the world could that be publishing news? Because after all, Mark Twain died about 100 years ago. But that's the point, actually, because Mark Twain left in his will the stipulation that his full autobiography was not to be published until 100 years after his death. Now, I've been looking at the first volume of this autobiography. It's an amazingly told story, which isn't a surprise given the fact that the narrator here is none other than Mark Twain himself, but it does leave us wondering what's going to be coming in subsequent volumes. Mark Twain was a fascinating figure. He was one who saw his own foibles in a light that very few authors have ever sought to share. At the same time, his worldview comes far more clearly in view when you read his autobiography than just about anything else. I have to tell you that I'm very excited about a publishing development that comes tomorrow with the release of The Colonel, the third and final installment of the massive biography of Theodore Roosevelt undertaken by biographer Edmund Morris. His first volume, The Rise of Theodore Roosevelt, appeared in 1979. It is one of the finest presidential biographies ever written. But of course, the man wasn't yet president. That came later with the second volume, Theodore Rex, which appeared in the year 2001. Colonel Roosevelt is a reversion to President Roosevelt's former title, his preferred title, and has to do with the very active post-presidency of Theodore Roosevelt's life. There's every reason to believe that Edmund Morris will tell this part of the story with the same gusto, style, and excitement of the first two volumes. This is a biographer of tremendous skill, and what a subject he had in Theodore Roosevelt. On the political front, I was struck by an article in the New York Times by Jennifer Steinhauer having to do with politicians who lost their offices in the election of just a few weeks ago. She writes about those who had served in Congress, either in the House or the Senate, for many years and found themselves unceremoniously dumped by the electorate. Now, that has to be a hard experience. Some of them were unwilling even to speak to her about the experience, such as Senator Arlen Specter, who shifted parties before the primary in order to run as a Democrat, only to lose in the primary, and thus to lose his seat in the Senate. Those who were profiled in the article include Michael Castle, a congressman who lost his race for the Republican nomination for the U.S. Senate from Delaware. He also lost his post. He said this, "I've been doing this a long time, and then all of a sudden you've been cast aside." He went on to say, "My wife argues it's almost better to lose the way we did because it all seems so irrational, but you lose, you lose. I wish we could say one way was fun. They're both pretty bad." Well, it turns out there's no good way to be cast out of office. And the last election cast a good number of incumbents out who had served in these posts for many years, some of them for decades. Jennifer Steinhauer's report comes with some data that Americans will find interesting. As she writes, "A career in Congress can be long, but the exit from glory is swift. Defeated and retiring members must vacate their offices at the end of the month so that all freshmen and their staffs can have offices by opening day." Earl Pomeroy, who lost his seat from North Dakota on the Democratic side, said, "There's not much time for a losing candidate to cope." Now, this underlines the human scale of politics. Most of the media coverage, understandably, is given over to partisan issues, to the maps of red states and blue states, and to the stories of those who have been swept into office. But the stories of those swept out of office are also a part of our political culture. They're also a part of the morality tale that is the larger context of American politics. There is something absolutely swift about a democracy. Perhaps, though, in this case, not swift enough, as Americans are likely to be frustrated with the fact that there is a lame duck Congress between the election and the sitting of the new Congress, which will come in just a few weeks. In any event, democracy works in just this way. One day you're an elected representative of the people, and the next day you're not. There is something there that is personally very difficult to bear. But for democracy, that's just the way it is. There is no inherited seat, or ought not to be. There is no absolutely certain seat, nor ought there to be. A democracy works in just this way. But behind every electoral shift, there are at least two very interesting stories. The story of the one coming in is interesting for sure. but so also is the story of the one going out. There is much to be learned in both cases. Finally, just how much would you be willing to give for the advancement of science? Well, that question certainly came to my mind with the proposal that has come from two scientists that we send a one-way mission to Mars. That's a one-way manned trip to Mars. The Associated Press reports from Pullman, Washington, that two scientists are suggesting that colonization of the red planet could happen faster and more economically if astronauts behaved like the first settlers to come to North America, not expecting to go home. Dirk Schultz-McCook, a Washington State University professor, and Paul Davies, a physicist at Arizona State University, are arguing that humans must begin colonizing another planet. Now, the main point of this news article is their proposal about a one-way trip to Mars. But the background to their worldview here is indicated by the fact that they believe that the Earth is likely to become uninhabitable by some future catastrophe. These are two very well-known physicists, and their particular scientific reputation here is not so much in question. But their judgment certainly is. Several people are suggesting that this is certainly premature, and there are deep moral questions involved. You want to know what some of them just might be? Well, consider this part of the report. You would need to send older folks around, somewhere around 60 or something like that, said Schultz-McCook. He said this because persons on the way to Mars will pass through so much ambient radiation that it certainly will have a devastating impact upon their health. Those who are in childbearing age, either male or female, would suffer irreparable damage to their reproductive systems. Now, I'm sure you thought you needed to know all that, but what we have in this case is an audacious scientific recommendation. That audacity is explained by the fact that the men who are making it believe that this planet is going to become uninhabitable. Now, you have to wonder, just who do they think they're going to convince to become these very first astronauts going all the way to Mars on a one-way trip? My guess is this is a scientific proposal that's not going to go anywhere fast, nor should it. There is something horribly pessimistic and troubling about scientists who believe that the Earth is going to become so uninhabitable that human life is going to have to be transferred, even in small numbers, to another planet in order to survive. It tells us something indeed that this kind of worldview now takes form of a proposal that is offered by two very well-recognized scientists. There you have it. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Moeller. For information about the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information about Boyce College, go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.